From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Now that the movie Ali is in the theaters, you may want to learn more about the great boxer. On today's Fresh Air, we feature an interview with David Remnick, whose book King of the World tells the story of Ali in the 60s, when he won the world heavyweight title, joined the Nation of Islam, and changed his name from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali. Also, George Foreman tells us about what it was like to be knocked out by Ali in the 1974 Rumble in the Jungle. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us why he's been tuned to cable for the best on television. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Army says an American Green Beret was killed today by small arms fire in eastern Afghanistan. A CIA agent was wounded in the shooting but is expected to survive. General Tommy Franks said the Green Beret was part of a team working with tribal leaders in the area. The soldier's name is being withheld until his family members have been notified. The FBI says a suspicious letter opened at the Capitol yesterday did not contain anthrax spores. Lab tests showed the substance in the letter was really talcum powder. A spokesman said the case will be treated as a criminal hoax. All mail to the Capitol is being screened and irradiated in an effort to kill any possible bioterrorism agents such as anthrax bacteria. Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle began a political year of midterm elections with a speech blasting the tax cut that President Bush pushed through Congress last year. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Flanked by five U.S. flags and reading from a teleprompter, Daschle struck a presidential pose as he detailed his take on what's gone wrong with the economy and what needs to be done to fix it. Daschle pointed out that instead of touting a budget surplus, Republicans are now predicting several years of budget deficits. Terrorist attacks, he said, have been a factor in the economic swoon.
But September 11th and the war aren't the only reasons the surplus is nearly gone. They're not even the biggest reason. The biggest reason is the tax cut.
Still, Daschle stopped short of calling for a repeal of the $1.35 trillion tax cut that's to be phased in over the next decade. Instead, he called for more spending on homeland security and tax breaks focused on spurring economic growth. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
In Nepal, leaders of seven South Asian nations are set to meet in a regional summit overshadowed by the continuing tension between India and Pakistan. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from Kathmandu.
Pakistan says it wants to talk to India on the sidelines of this meeting in an effort to diffuse tension, an idea embraced by the international community, but one rejected so far by India. Indian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Nirupama Rao today said there are no indications Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee will meet Pakistan's President General Pervez Musharraf, nor, she said, is it likely the two countries' foreign ministers will meet. The atmosphere, she said, is not conducive for dialogue. The military buildup by both sides follows the December 13th suicide attack on the Indian parliament, which left 14 people dead. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Kathmandu.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 87 points to close at 10,259 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 15 points to close at 2,059. The Nasdaq was up 72 points for the week. The S&P 500 gained 7 to close at 1,172. This is NPR News. The Supreme Court has agreed to consider a case regarding police powers to search and question people on public transportation. The case involves two men who were arrested for drug possession on a Greyhound bus in 1999. They argue that police didn't inform them of their rights and that they didn't feel free to leave. The Bush administration says police must have power to fight drug trafficking and terrorism. Job losses slowed in December, according to the Labor Department, but the U.S. unemployment rate continued to climb. NPR's John Idsty reports.
The jobless rate rose to 5.8% in December, up from a revised 5.6% the previous month. But employers reduced payrolls at a slower rate. The net loss of jobs was 124,000. That's compared to job cuts that averaged more than 400,000 in October and November. The smaller job losses and a slight increase in hours worked in the manufacturing sector were seen as further evidence that the U.S. recession may be coming to an end. Still, manufacturing, which has suffered most during this recession, continued to post big losses as 133,000 factory jobs were cut. 77,000 jobs were lost in the retail sector, but construction added 5,000 jobs last month, and government jobs increased by 63,000. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
The Irish rock band U2 led the Grammy nominations today with 8 nominations, including Best Record, Best Album, and Song of the Year. Singer Alicia Keys was also nominated for Best New Artist, along with nominations in 5 other categories. Classical music conductor Pierre Boulez was among the leaders. He had 6 nominations. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, the nature of what's to come, at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave.
Cassius, can I ask you how you're feeling now at this point in the
day? I'm feeling great. I'm ready to go to war right now.
Well, when you say you're ready to go to war right now...
I see that barrel in the street, I beat him before the fight.
You'd actually take him on before the fight?
Beat him like I'm his daddy.
I saw somebody listen a few days ago, Cash.
Ain't he ugly? He's too ugly to be the world champ. The world champ should be pretty like me.
Well, he told me to bet my life that you wouldn't go 3 rounds.
Well, if you want to lose your money, then bet on money.
May I ask you
because
this?
I'll never lose a fight. It's impossible, tell him. It's impossible.
Never lost a fight in your life.
That's any of my fans. When was the last time they lost? I'm too fast.
Champion for
I'm
the
king. Born the champ.
Born the champ from the crib.
Ah! I'm not only a fighter. I'm a poet. I'm a prophet. I'm the resurrector. I'm the savior of the boxing world. If it wasn't for me, the game would be dead.
That was Cassius Clay in 1964, shortly before he took the world heavyweight title from Sonny Liston. The day after that fight, Clay took on a new name, Muhammad Ali. The new film about Ali, starring Will Smith, begins in 1964 as the fighter is preparing for his match with Liston and follows his life through his Rumble in the Jungle match with George Foreman 10 years later. We'll hear an interview with Foreman from our archives later on today's program. Although his outspokenness initially alienated many Americans in the mainstream, Ali became a beloved American hero. He became famous not just for his rhymes and his abilities in the ring, but for his religion and his politics. In 1998, Terry Gross spoke with journalist David Remnick about Ali. Remnick began his career as a sports writer for The Washington Post. He became the Post's Russian correspondent and went on to write about Russia and other subjects for The New Yorker. He's now the editor of that magazine. His book about Ali is called King of the World.
You say that Ali entered the world of boxing at a time when the expectation was that a black fighter would behave with absolute deference to white sensibilities. Give me an example of what you mean there.
Well, the champion at the time when Muhammad Ali, then Cassius Clay, was in the Olympics, he was then a light heavyweight in the 1960 Rome Olympics, was Floyd Patterson. And Floyd Patterson was certainly no era-shaking fighter. He was not Joe Louis by any stretch of the imagination, but he imitated Joe Louis as a social type for reasons of being accepted by the white world, by white columnists like Jimmy Cannon or Red Smith. And Patterson was a champion for a very brief time before he was utterly destroyed in the ring twice by Sonny Liston, who was a different type, who was somebody who was a destroyer who was in his time was a fighter not unlike Mike Tyson and a personality not unlike Mike Tyson, a kind of an extremely scary figure to everyone. The NAACP endorsed Floyd Patterson before his fight with Sonny Liston because they were so terrified that Sonny Liston would come along and occupy this place in the American culture, which really only accepted black men as athletes, and it would be bad for the race, essentially. But lo and behold, Sonny Liston was the superior fighter and beat Floyd Patterson twice, both times in the first round.
Well, Ali, when you interviewed him, told you that he wanted to be a new kind of black man when he became famous as a fighter. How do you see him fitting in as a new kind of black man in the world of boxing?
Well, he was what's still called a race man. Not that Liston or Patterson weren't necessarily, but he was, in a new and surprising way, he represented a generational shift that took whites and middle-class blacks as well by surprise. He was the forerunner to the Black Power movement. He was the forerunner to the draft resistance movement. He came along at a time when these sort of things were unknown to whites. He grew up in a household in which his father was a fairly humble sign painter in Louisville, Kentucky. And his father was deeply influenced, as were many blacks throughout the country in the 20s, 30s, and thereafter, by Marcus Garvey, black nationalism of a kind that whites had no clue about. And by the time he, even before he was fighting, he was filled with this notion of what a black man, what a black woman, what anyone in segregated Louisville had to live through and suffer, and he would have none of it.
Well, before he became politicized and before he joined the Nation of Islam, he became known for his really flamboyant style of showmanship, and particularly for his great rhyming. And what insights did you get about how he developed that showmanship and the verbal flamboyance?
It began at the beginning. He had his first fight when he was 12 years old. Another kid had stolen his bicycle, and little Cassius Clay was very angry. And he went down to a basement gym run by a cop in town named Joe Martin. And Joe Martin said, "Stop being so angry and stop threatening to beat everybody up, and why don't you learn how to fight?" And so Cassius Clay learned how to fight and put on gigantic gloves. He was a little skinny kid. And he fought one of those sort of church basement-type fights. And he won a split decision, 12 years old, 98 pounds. And his reaction afterwards was, "I am the greatest. I will be champion of the world. I am the greatest." The rhetoric that you would hear years and years later, and you would think he invented it last week, it came out of his mouth after a split decision against another 12-year-old.
What was Sonny Liston's reaction to Ali's kind of playful but also aggressive verbal showmanship before their first championship bout
together? Fury and confusion. Sonny Liston was a very simple man, intellectually limited, emotionally limited, and this drove him crazy. He was a great and powerful fighter. He thought he would have no trouble with this guy who fought like Sugar Ray Robinson. He danced around the ring, which, you know, was a bit fey for a heavyweight after all. And Cassius Clay, who was fearful of Sonny Liston in his heart because he knew how powerful he was, he had seen what he had done to Floyd Patterson, wanted to find a way to get to his mind, to unnerve him, to scare him, to make him second guess, to think really that he was crazy, because the one thing that Sonny Liston couldn't deal with was somebody who was nuts. Always in prison, where Sonny Liston had spent some time, the person you never dealt with, the person you always avoided, was the crazy man. That's what you avoided. And so, and Cassius Clay knew that. I'm calling him Clay now because that's who he was at the time. And Clay did things like, you know, drive his bus to Sonny Liston's house in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock in the morning, run up to the door and start pounding on the door, screaming and yelling and acting like an insane person. And Sonny Liston would come out on the lawn in his shorty bathrobe, not knowing what to make of this guy. And it really unnerved him. And Clay and then Ali did it over and over and over again. And the one thing Sonny Liston couldn't deal with was a madman.
Of course.
But for Clay, of course, it was all by design. And the most famous instance of it was the weigh-in before the first fight. The weigh-in, Cassius Clay comes in and starts screaming and yelling. Usually these are routine performances in which you really don't do anything other than get weighed and flex your muscles and get the hell out of there. All he's screaming and yelling, "I'm going to destroy him," and he's jumping at Liston, and his pulse rate is up to God knows what it was, hundreds and hundreds above of what it should have been. And then an hour later, after it was over, he was absolutely normal and took a nap. It was the most amazing performance, and Sonny Liston went into that ring thinking he was dealing with a nut.
It's a very wrestling kind of attitude to have, that type of showmanship.
Well, it's funny you should say that. One of the influences on his showmanship was Gorgeous George, who was the Hulk Hogan of his time. Gorgeous George, a professional wrestler who wore his long blonde tresses down past his shoulder blades, who sprayed himself with eau de cologne before going in the ring, who caused everyone to hate him, also knew how to fill an arena. And before one of his minor fights, before the championship fights, Clay went and saw Gorgeous George. He was on a radio show with him, and he learned from Gorgeous George. Now, he didn't imitate Gorgeous George. He got all this rhetoric from the dozens, playing the dozens on the street, from his father, who was a braggart, from Marcus Garvey, from The Air, from God knows what. But he had an amazing ability, Muhammad Ali did, of assimilating influences that were in the air and making them his own.
David Remnick speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with David Remnick. His book about Muhammad Ali is called King of the World.
How was Ali introduced to Islam?
It's strange. We think he was influenced when he first went down to Miami and basically met some street guys who were selling, Nation of Islam newspapers. Not so. When he was an amateur fighter, still in high school, he would go in a station wagon with some other amateurs from Louisville and fight in regional fights. And one time he was up in Chicago. At that time, the Nation of Islam was completely centered in Chicago. Elijah Muhammad lived there. And as a kid, he was wandering around on the street, and he was given a copy of Muhammad Speaks, and he also bought a record album of Elijah Muhammad's rhetoric, his sermons, essentially. And he brought these home, and he was completely taken up by it. Clearly, this was a searching kid, not an intellectual powerhouse, not a master of his schoolwork, but a searching mind, someone deeply troubled by the segregated place where he grew up with, deeply troubled by the fact that his father was a sign painter who really believed he should have been an artist and was held down. And these things influenced him, and for his senior paper, in his senior year of high school, he wanted to write a paper on the Nation of Islam. Well, no one had hardly heard of the Nation of Islam in Louisville. And the teacher said, no, you can't write about this strange and ultimately threatening thing. So there was the seed of it. And then, of course, it blossomed when he became a professional fighter after the Olympics and started meeting with Muslims and Muslim teachers in Miami.
You say that when he became a member of the Nation of Islam, that Elijah Muhammad was ambivalent about Cassius Clay and ambivalent about boxing in general. What was that ambivalence about?
He was ambivalent about boxing because he thought, not unreasonably, that the history of boxing, in the United States especially, is rooted in slavery. It's rooted in the spectacle of strong black men made to fight each other for the amusement of whites. And Elijah Muhammad was, for obvious reasons, all against that. On the other hand, although he saw Elijah Muhammad as the spiritual father of the movement, the person he was closest to was Malcolm X. Malcolm X was not bothered much by boxing. In fact, Malcolm X was a pretty good athlete growing up. He liked these things. And so he was able to sort of dance the dance for a while. And Malcolm X was extremely close with Clay and was down in Miami with him leading up to that first dramatic fight with Liston. They both stayed at the Hampton Court Hotel, and Malcolm was there as Clay's guest with his wife. And they became extremely close. It was the formative relationship where politics and where religion was concerned prior to Cassius Clay becoming Muhammad Ali. But then the story turns.
Yeah, well, Ali kind of got in the middle of the dispute between Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X.
Exactly. And Malcolm X's dispute with Elijah Muhammad had to do with a number of things, including the fact that Elijah Muhammad had fathered children outside of his marriage, which Malcolm X objected to. financial irregularities, the fact that Malcolm X thought that Elijah Muhammad was putting himself far too forward, despite his leadership of the movement, and they split in the most dramatic way possible just before this fight. And Malcolm X went down to Miami as much for a vacation, a psychic vacation for himself. No, until then, by the way, no one really knew that Cassius Clay was, in effect, a member of the Nation of Islam. He knew very well, was very sophisticated about this, that if he announced that he was an adherent to the Nation of Islam before the title fight, the fight would never happen. And in fact, the promoter of the fight, Bill McDonald, did find out, because there were some press leaks, and he threatened to call the whole fight off, and Clay refused to renounce anything, and they came to a compromise. And the compromise, he would wait till after the fight to announce this. So in the course of 24 hours, in February 1964, Cassius Clay became heavyweight champion of the world to the shock of the entire sporting world, and the next morning announced to the shock of everyone that he was a new and different man, a member of the Nation of Islam.
Ali told you when you were talking with him that one of his greatest regrets was basically having abandoned Malcolm in favor of Elijah Muhammad.
When I went up to visit Muhammad Ali in Berrien Springs, Michigan, where he lives on a farm, one of the first things he did was take an 8x10 glossy out of his briefcase and show it to me, rather silently, because he doesn't speak that much now, for obvious reasons. And it was a way of showing me that, you know, here I am with Malcolm X. The picture was of him and Malcolm X. And it was a very moving way of showing me, you know, he wasn't taking a picture out of Elijah Muhammad or some other fight. It was this relationship that he was deeply proud of. And I think in some ways sorry about, because, as you know, after he became champion, Malcolm X went up to New York with Clay, soon to become Ali. They were great friends. They went to the UN. They hung out at the Hotel Teresa in Harlem and all the rest. But then Elijah Muhammad put his foot down and demanded that he choose, the fighter choose, between Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X. And he did. He chose. And he rejected Malcolm X severely and immediately and completely. So much so that on a subsequent trip to Africa some weeks later, they literally, Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali, bumped into each other in a hotel lobby. Malcolm X tried to approach him in the friendliest way possible. And Muhammad Ali simply mocked him, made fun of him. And that was the end of it. And of course, a year later, Malcolm X was gunned down at the Audubon Ballroom uptown in Manhattan.
Ali's showmanship certainly helped sell tickets for his fights. What about his membership in the Nation of Islam? A lot of white people saw the Nation as being an anti-white group and were very alienated by Ali's conversion. How did that affect who showed up at his fights?
Well, at first, it was a great threat. And as you know, in the second Liston fight, first of all, they could barely get a venue. They could barely find a place to fight. There was the threat of the mob. There was also the specter of the Nation of Islam. And a championship fight was held in a small town in Maine in front of just a few thousand people, 3,000-4,000 people. I mean, this is unimaginable. This is when boxing, by the way, was still big. In 1998, perhaps you could believe it, when boxing has kind of faded and become almost vestigial, with the exception of certain fighters, Tyson, Holyfield, Oscar De La Hoya. And you can be sure that had its effect. And certainly when he refused the draft, this sense of alienation, this sense of division between Ali and his public only deepened. And he,
well, for some people it deepened, and for others, like for you, for instance, it kind of strengthened the connection to him. Because there were so many young people
later,
who were alienated.
Later.
Well, that's
but
true. That's true.
Remember,
right.
this is us
early.
Thinking backward.
Right.
Also, I was a kid at the time.
Right.
Certainly, if you were 19 years old and against the war, you thought this was a pretty amazing thing, that this fighter would step away from the heavyweight championship, quite likely never to fight again, to give up probably tens of millions of dollars, giving up the one thing he could do, fight, because it's not as if he's then going to go off to law school. And you saw this as enormous bravery, at a time when the anti-war movement was still in its infancy. This was, you know, remember, this is early 1967. the level of avoiding the draft was nothing like it would be 2 years later.
You know, I think early on when Ali became a member of the Nation of Islam and then became anti-war, I think some people just saw that as a sign of his eccentricity as opposed to as a sign of his deep commitment to certain beliefs.
You know, what always saved Ali, what always saved him from becoming alienated from certain publics, whether it was the bragging or the politics or the religion, anything, there was always a sense of humor about him. He was always funny, hilarious. And finally, with time, he won over almost everybody. I mean, a few racists here and there, a few people who really felt that his stand on Vietnam was deeply, deeply wrong, a few people that, you know, still yearned for the Joe Lewis model of behavior, fine. But for the most part, he won over the world so that at the 1996 Olympics, he gets up and lights this torch in the most unexpected, dramatic, and moving and beautiful way. And no one's presence on this globe doing that would have moved us more.
David Remnick, speaking with Terry Gross. His book about Muhammad Ali in the 60s is called King of the World. It's now out in paper. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
For those of you who won't be able to see the Clay Liston fight, here's the eighth round exactly as it will happen. Clay comes out to meet Liston, and Liston starts to retreat. If Liston goes back in his father, he'll end up in the ringside seat. Clay swings with his left. Clay swings with his right. Look at young Cassius carry the fight. Liston keeps backing, but there's not enough room. It's a matter of time, and Clay lowers the boom. Now Liston disappears from view. The crowd is getting frantic, but our radar stations have picked him up. He is somewhere over the Atlantic.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Dr. Murray's Total Body Tune-Up by Michael T. Murray, M.D., co-author of Encyclopedia of Natural Medicine. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Civil Warriors, The Legal Siege on the Tobacco Industry by Dan Ziegart, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Fighting Sonny Liston. We continue our conversation about Muhammad Ali with David Remnick. George Foreman tells us about his Rumble in the Jungle with Ali in 1974. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us why cable seems to be beating the broadcast networks to the punch. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's continue Terry's interview with David Remnick. His book, King of the World, tells the story of Muhammad Ali in the 60s, when he became famous for his rhymes, won the world heavyweight title, joined the Nation of Islam, and changed his name from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali.
Let's get to his actual championship fights with Sonny Liston, and you keep coming back to this through the book. Ali almost ended the first championship fight with Liston because his eyes were burning so much he couldn't even see. And I guess there's always been the rumor that Sonny Liston may have juiced his gloves, meaning put some kind of substance on his gloves that would have ended up in Ali's eyes. A chemical of some sort.
My reporting tells me that's beyond rumor, that really was the case.
That it really was the case?
What had happened was he got into the ring. Sonny Liston got into this ring having trained for no more than a 5-round fight. He really thought, in the way Mike Tyson dealing with Michael Spinks or some inferior fighter, that he would dispatch with this loudmouth kid very quickly and go out to dinner. First round happens, and this kid is faster than Sugar Ray Robinson, and he's sticking a jab in his face, and welts are coming up, and he cannot touch him. Liston cannot touch him. He's missing by not 3 inches, but by 2 feet. Round two, same thing. And on it goes, and all that is left to Sonny Liston as he gets more and more tired, as his hands begin to sink to his side. Boxing is an extraordinarily exhausting process, especially if you haven't trained, that he decides to cheat. And with the help of one of his corner men, he puts some substance on his gloves. Now, do we have this from Sonny Liston? No, Sonny's dead. We don't have it from the corner man, Joe Pollino, who's dead. But we have it from a very, very close friend of both Liston and Joe Pollino, Jack McKinney, a reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News at the time and a close friend of both, that he put some substances, whether it was Munsell solution or some sort of liniment, on the gloves, something he had done before, by the way. And he gets it in Clay's eyes. And Clay sits down in the corner and he tells Angelo Dundee, cut off the gloves. I can't see. I'm blind. Cut them off. He wants to quit. It's the one thing that he didn't know how to deal with, being blind. I mean, he knew he was beating Sonny Liston to the punch every single step of the way. And Angelo Dundee quickly gets as much water into his eyes as possible, into his fighter's eyes. And tells him, baby, you ain't quitting. This is for the big one. This is for the title. No quitting now. Just go out, dance, yardstick him, which means keep your left out as far as you can. Keep your distance. You have a slight reach thing. You've got the speed. And wait till it flushes out. Meanwhile, in the corner, the black Muslims are sitting there screaming and yelling that Angelo Dundee is a member of the mob, and he's juiced the gloves. That it's Angelo Dundee who's responsible for this, because after all, he has an Italian name, and the mob is still all over boxing at the time. The mob controlled Sonny Liston. So this is the drama going on in the space of 60 seconds. Angelo Dundee somehow convinces the referee not to come over to the corner and end the whole thing. Ali goes back out. Eventually, the stuff washes out of his eyes, and he finishes the job. He continues to frustrate Liston, and Liston finally just will not get off his stool to come out and fight the 7th round. End of story.
So Ali becomes the heavyweight champion there, and then there's a rematch. And the rematch is extraordinary because Ali knocks him out so quickly.
Well, it's a bizarre fight. It's held in Lewiston, Maine, which is, a textile town, a tiny town with, one strip joint and two restaurants and a hotel in Poland Springs. And all the sports writers are whining and why are we here and all the rest. And the first it was scheduled for Boston and Ali had some health problems and it was delayed. They go into the ring and the atmosphere, everybody's fearing that the Muslims are going to shoot somebody and that the mob is there and that the fix is in and so on and so forth. They come out. Ali does his thing. He's dancing around the ring, dancing around the ring. Liston is struggling to keep up. All of a sudden, Ali turns, pivots, hits Liston with the fastest punch that slow motion has ever recorded. Down goes Liston. The timekeeper loses all sense of how to do his job. The referee is Jersey Joe Walcott, who really, fine fighter, bad referee. Confusion. It was it was a disaster in terms of organization. End of fight. Probably the most ambiguous and strange heavyweight title fight of all time.
They were,
or at least since the long count of Dempsey long ago.
There were rumors that Liston was actually pressured to fall, you know, that he was pressured to...
To take a dive.
To take a dive, yeah. Any truth in that, do you think?
I don't think so.
You watched this on slow motion and saw the punch.
I probably watched it as many times as I've seen The Godfather, which is an embarrassing number as well. I probably watched that fight 50 times.
Uh-huh.
Because it doesn't take too long. It takes an hour to watch it 50 times. And he hit him. He hit him with a perfectly timed, short overhand right that hit him perfectly on the side of the head. Kaboom. And it's also in the first round when the fighters are cold. That punch probably would not have knocked him out in the seventh round. But in the first round, when two fighters are cold, the likelihood is far greater that it can. And, you know, my feeling is about Sonny Liston and Muhammad Ali, if they fought 10 times, Muhammad would win 9, at least. He beat him.
You wonder if Ali maybe already had Parkinson's very early, mild form of it before his last fight, and that might have affected him in the ring.
It's unclear. I'm not a doctor. Freddie Pacheco, who was who is a doctor and was in his corner, left his corner because he was deeply concerned that certainly by the time you got to the Larry Holmes fight, something was deeply wrong. It's quite clear that in the best of all possible worlds, at the very latest, Muhammad Ali should have quit the ring after his third fight, the so-called Thriller in Manila with Joe Frazier in 1975. And he went on too long. And Ferdy Pacheco very wisely said that Muhammad Ali was el único, the unique one, except in the way, and that he was not about boxing. He was about other things. Boxing's almost happened to be a component of him. But what was not unique about Muhammad Ali is the arc of his story was like so many great fighters. He went on way too long in an extremely dangerous, morally dubious, probably, enterprise. And the great curse of Muhammad Ali's later career is that he discovered that he could take a punch. When he came back from exile, he realized that he couldn't dance away from everything the way he could as a kid. And so he learned a new way to fight, and part of it was absorbing punishment in the gym, absorbing punishment in the real fight itself. And so while Muhammad may have won most of these fights in his second career, in almost all of them he absorbed enormous punishment. And from terrific fighters, Ernie Shavers, George Foreman, Joe Frazier 3 times, Jimmy Young, Larry Holmes, and then from second-rate fighters who began to hit him as well. And this took its enormous toll, and no one can finally decide whether punching or the genetics of neurology conspired in what proportion to lead to the condition he's in now, but clearly fighting had its toll.
David Remnick, speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. Remnick is now the editor of The New Yorker. His book about Muhammad Ali, King of the World, is available in paperback. Coming up, The Rumble in the Jungle, an interview with heavyweight champ George Foreman. This is Fresh Air. In 1974, George Foreman and Muhammad Ali met in Zaire for a heavyweight championship bout. The Rumble in the Jungle was the only fight Foreman ever lost by a knockout. Foreman retired from boxing in 77, had a religious experience, and took up preaching. He was ordained in 1978 and soon after started his own church and youth center in Houston. But 9 years later, Foreman staged a comeback. To the amazement and pleasure of many middle-aged people, Foreman regained the title in 1994 when he was 45 years old. He eventually relinquished the title for refusing to fight a challenger and finally retired from the ring in 1997. Terry Gross spoke with Foreman in 1995. He still held the title then and had just written his autobiography, By George.
You started off as a street fighter. Mm-hmm. How did that affect your approach to boxing when you started to box?
Devastating, because I met Doc Brodus, my first boxing coach, in 66 in the Job Corps Center. I said, hey, I want to be a boxer. He said, okay, you're big enough, you're ugly enough, come on down to the gym. I remember going down to the gym, and he put me in the ring with a little guy, a little skinny guy, no muscles, you can see his ribs. I said, boy, I invited all my friends to watch my boxing match. I thought it was going to be just like on the streets. Jumped in the ring, I never did was able to land one blow. The guy would move out of the way and hit me with this thing called a jab. And I'd charge him and try to grab him, and the referees would say, you can't wrestle. So it was a hard thing to abandon my street fighting tactics and move into another thing where I had to learn how to do box. I had to learn a new style, a whole new existence of fighting.
What was the hardest thing to give up from your street fighting style?
Grabbing. In the streets, I'd hit you and hit you. If you move out of the way, I would grab you and get you. In the ring, you were not able to, you can only use your fists. You can't open your hand and grab anyone. Plus, I wanted to bite too, but he had a mouthpiece.
Now, what about the kind of finesse that your trainer was trying to teach you?
Yeah, it was a long time before I could really comprehend what he was saying. George, you're not going to be able to just knock everybody out and run over everybody. You're going to have to learn this sport. And it took a few defeats before I decided I had to dedicate my life to learning more than just being powerful and strong. I had to learn this as a sport, jabbing and finesse, as you call it.
Did you used to psych yourself up before you entered the ring to get yourself to be really angry or to really hate your opponent?
Yeah, Dick Sattler, my first trainer, manager, in 69, I told him I wanted to be a boxer. He said he would teach me how to be a boxer, and I'd move in the ring and practice every day, styles, dancing, prancing, and I really wanted to be the next Muhammad Ali, that kind of stuff. So my first boxing match in Madison Square Garden, 1969, Donald Waldheim. Dick Sattler gets me into the dress room. He rubs me down. He takes water away from me for 2 days. Then he starts cussing. This blankety blank is trying to stop your life. You go out there, and I mean, you knock him out. You hit him here. If he hides, you hit him behind. And he cusses and cusses and cusses. You hear me? Push him like this. And he asks me to push him, and I pushes him. By the time I get into that ring, I'm like a wind-up killer. And I thought he was going to let me be a boxer. From that point on, he would wind me up like a doll every time. It was not about my psyching myself up. He would engineer this creature.
Was that effective for you?
Oh, yes. When I got into that ring, sorry for a guy who didn't know how to protect himself. I remember boxing a guy, I think maybe in Seattle, Washington. I can't remember his name. We're a match, and I jumped out on this kid, and I tried to hit him, and I missed him. And I tried to hit him again, I'd miss him. I'd hit him in the back. Finally, I barely missed him, and he hit the floor. People threw candy wrappers, cigarette butts. They were booing. I said, get up, man, get up. Don't do this. And later on after the fight, he walked up to me, and he saw I was really feeling down about what happened. They counted him out, but he wasn't out. He looked me in the eye. He said, you know, you really want to kill someone, don't you? He said, that's what you wanted. You wanted to kill me. He said, I wasn't going to get up for you to kill me.
Huh.
Do you understand? So I had this killer instinct, and it wasn't. And the sad thing, I'm upset with a guy because he won't get up and let me kill him. And for the first time, I realized that the best thing he could have done was just stay down there.
Now, so you got really psyched up with this killing instinct to get into the ring. Could you turn that off when a match was over?
You know, it's strange because you think you can turn it off, but later on, you're fighting once, twice, sometimes three times in a month. You go home and you say to yourself, it's over now. I'm going to go back. Finally, this stuff follows you around all the time. And if you're not careful, people see the best side of you in the ring. The awful side of you is outside of the ring. As you get closer, I'm having knockout after knockout. I'm starting to look at myself in the mirror. I see this body. I see this face. I see this man who's going to be heavyweight champ of the world. He is the king of men. He can beat anybody in the room. And you get into a room with guys and you start thinking, nobody can whip me. So it wasn't something you could turn on and off. It was something that stayed with you all the time, as a matter of fact. I remember winning a championship of the world. I defeated Joe Frazier. And I remember thinking, I can beat anybody in the world. Anybody. And it followed me around from restaurant, everywhere I would go.
How did that get in the way of things?
It got in the way of my life, because I no longer had a life. I mean, I wouldn't meet a friend. I was like, I'm meeting people that I could whip. You know, right. Size you up. You know you can't whip me, don't you? Hi. You know you can't whip me. So you lose a life because 24 hours a day you are the heavyweight champ of the world in your mind.
Now, how did that affect your relationship with women?
Same way. Hey, you're with the best man. You're with the men of men. You're with the best man. You're with the strongest, toughest, mightiest man in the world. And you felt like that. That's why it was so crumbling when I was defeated by Muhammad Ali. I was knocked out in 74. I'd never lost a boxing match as a professional. Counted out. It was like, man, I'm ashamed to go into the room with people now. They're going to know I'm not the best. You get in a room with a woman, and she knows. She knows that I'm not the best. Maybe I should keep my clothes on. You know, this not only beats you, it's like you are stripped of your manhood.
Because all you were was the
all
best,
I,
right? That's,
all I was the heavyweight, the best. And now there's someone better, and they all know. You figure I'm going to keep my clothes on. Oh, I'm going to put on some dog glasses so they won't know who I am, so they can say, you know, there's one better than you. Like the old saying, mirror, mirror on the wall. And the mirror speak back, oh, there's someone else. I had to live through that, and it devastated my life. I felt like it was the most devastating thing that ever happened to me, because when I lost the title to Muhammad Ali, I felt like I lost my manhood, what I considered manhood.
Now, would you feel that way if you lost a bout now?
Oh, no. It was, I fought Ronnie Lyles back in 76 after losing the title. Because I told people I could have gotten up in the ring in Africa. I could have done this. I could have won. You look for every excuse. But there I am in Caesar's Palace. Ronnie Lyles, a big, strong guy, knocked me down. I'm bleeding on the canvas. I jump up. He knocks me down again. Then I knock him down. He has me on the floor bleeding. Finally, after beating the count two or three times, I knock him out. I felt restored again. Like, oh, I'm a man again. It wasn't Muhammad Ali, but I had my manhood again. I believed in myself a little bit. And I thought that people said, oh, George is tough now. So I got it back. Eventually, I lost to Jimmy Young in 77, and I found something even greater than manhood. I found God, you see, and he gave me something. I was able to admit I lost a boxing match and found a little peace within myself. And it has nothing to do with winning a boxing match or losing anything. It's peace of mind.
Now, you said that when you lost to Ali in 74, that you weren't knocked out. You were just staying down to the count of eight, but when you got up, the referee.
See, we were told, as a fighter, Archie Moore was one of my trainers, and Dick Sattler was his previous trainer, and corner man. If you're knocked down, there wasn't any mandatory eight count as there is now. No matter if you're knocked down, you get up, you still have to be counted eight to clear your head up. This time in Africa, they tell me, when you're knocked down, always look to your corner. Don't listen to the referee. Let your corner count. Get your head clear. And when the corner tell you to get up, get up. So I was knocked down, and I looked around and found my corner. They told me to stay down, which is what they're supposed to do. Then when they told me to jump up, I jumped up. The fight was over. But I was never out, never. I started thinking, all night I've pursued Muhammad Ali. He covered up with the rope-a-dope. He wouldn't mix it up. I could knock him out if he only mixes it up. And I'm on the floor thinking, now he's going to come out for the kill and try to finish me off. I'm going to knock him out now. That's what I was waiting to do. When I jumped up, they said it was over. The referee counted quick.
So you're angry?
Oh, I was devastated. I'd wake up in the night sweating, thinking, why didn't I just get up? Why did I trust my corner?
What did you say to the people in your corner?
I fired them. I never worked with them again.
Now, one last question. Is it true that all of your sons are named George?
We have four boys, all named George Edward Foreman.
Why did you name them all George?
That was a pretty good name.
Okay.
You were trying to talk about my name? Take that. No, but literally, I didn't find out who my biological father was until after I had lost the title of the world. I had already had taste devastation. Then one sister came up to me and said, you know, daddy is not your daddy. I said, what do you mean? You want to fight? She said, nope. And I had to search and find this guy, and I only became friends with him. We were friends maybe, 2 years, and he was dead. I didn't know anything about that man. And I figured I better do something. All my boys, I'm not going to one junior and then another. I'm going to name them all George Foreman. They're going to have to sort it out and understand more about it as they get older. But I have to, when you can't find roots, plant something. And George is a good root.
George Foreman from a 1995 interview with Terry Gross. Coming up, critic David Biancooley says he can't get enough of cable TV. This is Fresh Air. The December holiday season is over, the calendar has turned, and TV is getting ready to get back to business. TV critic David Biancooley says that even this early in the game, cable seems to be beating the broadcast networks to the punch.
If it seems like a long time since TV's been worth watching, that's because it has been. But check out what's in store this Sunday. On HBO, the season premieres of Oz and Sex and the City. On Showtime, the season premieres of The Chris Isaak Show and Queer as Folk. All of them on cable, all of them about to roll out new episodes every week without interruption, and all of them, except for Queer as Folk, absolutely excellent. Cable networks like HBO and Showtime used to be in the pay movie business. That's why people subscribe to them and watch them and talk about them. You could watch movies at home without commercials or editing, and that was enough to keep subscribers coming. Then came the VCR and the home video market, and eventually the DVD. Now cable figures the best way to keep viewers tuned in is to create and present programs they can't see anywhere else. Programs that, for the most part, can't be shown on network TV, either because of raw content or out of the mainstream subject matter. The Larry Sanders Show, Gary Shandling's fabulous send-up of talk shows and celebrity culture, was an early HBO triumph. Dream On, a sexy comedy about a divorced man in New York, was another. And now we have, on cable, the brilliance of The Sopranos, the boldness of 6 Feet Under, and all the shows that are returning this Sunday. Oz and Sex and the City deserve special mention for completely different reasons. Oz deserves praise because it predated Sopranos, has been just as daring and even more consistent, and is the exact kind of show, a drama set in a maximum security prison, that seems unthinkable on broadcast television. And Sex and the City, which also predated Sopranos, gets credit for improving greatly since it began. In the show's first 2 seasons, the women on the show, portrayed so confidently and playfully by Sarah Jessica Parker, Kim Cattrall, Kristen Davis, and Cynthia Nixon, seemed aimless, rootless, and unchanging. Men came and went, and commitments were rare and fleeting. But that all changed more recently as the characters allowed love and other complications into their lives. As we begin this new mini-season, Parker's Carrie has invited her new boyfriend to move in. Cattrall's Samantha has become strongly attached to a man who's as casual about sex as she is. Davis's Charlotte is trying to save her new marriage. And Nixon's Miranda, who has no plans for marriage, is having a baby. So when these ladies meet these days for lunch, a constant staple of Sex and the City, the discussions are less about sex than before. In fact, for unusually large chunks, their conversations can even be played on the radio.
A plant. The man brought a living thing into my apartment. I don't do plants. I kill everything I bring in there.
You said yes to moving in. The guy moved in.
But he's taking over whole areas.
This is why I've never lived with a man. This and the fact that I want them out an hour after I climax.
You let them stay a whole hour?
You'd be surprised how many are ready to go again after a quick catnap.
And there's no walls, you know. There's nowhere to hide. As soon as I walk in the door, he's all up in my face with, who'd you see? Where'd you go? Who'd you meet? What do you know? What I know is I need time to decompress. Just be alone.
But Carrie, there are gonna have to be some adjustments. Relationships are hard.
Oh, you guys, I miss walking into my apartment with no one there and it's all quiet. And I can do that stuff you do when you're totally alone. Things you would never want your boyfriend to see you do.
Like masturbate?
My SSB, my secret single behavior. Like, I like to make a stack of saltines. I put grape jelly on them. I eat them standing up in the kitchen, reading fashion magazines.
Why standing up?
Oh, it's weird, but it just feels great.
I like to put Vaseline on my hands and put them in those Borghese conditioning gloves while watching infomercials. Before I was married, I used to study my pores in a magnifying mirror for an hour each night. But I'm afraid Trey will just think it's weird.
Well, he would. You can't do that stuff in front of men. What about you, Lolita? Anything you do you wouldn't want a man to see?
No. You know I believe her.
The series is facing new issues, too, and none of these relationships is taken lightly or resolved easily. By the end of this new group of shows, Sex and the City presents its best and most dramatic episodes yet and ought to help keep HBO subscribers happy. On broadcast TV, meanwhile, they're taking at least a few lessons from cable. On Fox, the exciting different series 24 is being shown twice weekly in primetime. That's a programming move stolen from cable, and one that nets a few million extra viewers a week without costing any more money. And on all the networks, quirky, entertaining new shows, such as Undeclared, Scrubs, Alias, and Smallville, are succeeding by thinking more like cable. Instead of trying to program shows that will appeal to everyone, the networks are presenting well-made series that are more likely to please some of the people some of the time. And in this new century, in this era of narrowcasting and a fragmented TV universe, that's really the best way to succeed.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. We'll close today's show with music from jazz pianist Ralph Sutton, who died earlier this week at the age of 79. Sutton was one of the most eminent stride pianists, playing in the tradition of Harlem piano players James P. Johnson and Fats Waller. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of The Core Program, the 15 minutes a day program that can change your life, by physical therapist Peggy Brill. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Learning to Fall, The Blessings of an Imperfect Life by Philip Simmons. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about one of the most potent racial epithets with Harvard Law professor Randall Kennedy, author of Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word. Join us for the next Fresh Air.